Welcome to this week's W3C CCG meeting. Today we have Manu, our beloved Manu, here to present on the parallel signatures in verifiable credentials. Actually, he has sent a deck in advance already. So, later on you can just open that deck and then go along with it. So, thanks a lot. But before then, just a quick administrative stuff. A quick reminder on the code of ethics and professional conduct. Just want to be sure that we hold constructive conversations and respectful conversations here. A quick note on the intellectual property. Anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be member of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. So if you have any questions in regards to getting a W3C account or signing the community contributor license, please just let any of the co-chairs know. These meetings are being automatically recorded and transcribed, and we'll try to publish the meeting recordings, video recordings, audio recordings, and transcriptions in the next 1 to 2 days. We use GC Chat to queue the speakers during the call, so you can type in Q+ to add yourself to the queue, or Q-, and you can type in Q? To see who's in the queue, and I will moderate the queue. All right, any introductions or reintroductions? If you're new to the community or you haven't been active and want to re-engage, please feel free to just unmute.
Yeah, maybe I just wanted to say hi. It's my first time on this particular call. I've been attending the VCAPI and the traceability specific interop calls. I work at the Digital Trust Laboratory of Canada. My name is Patrick. I've been in this space for about 4 years. Attended IW twice. And I'm mostly looking at sort of merging the add-on creds space with the W3 space, more specifically with the new work with the add-on creds as a data integrity proof format, which is why I was interested by this call. So happy to meet everyone on this call.
Great. Welcome, Patrick, and very excited to have you here as well. All right, any other introductions or reintroductions? All right, any announcements and reminders? Manu, please.
Just a couple. Let's see. The California DMV made some pretty interesting announcements last Friday. I don't know how much I can share right now, but everyone here got the invite for it, right? So if you attended, you saw some things. I think there'll be some, a press around that stuff this week or next week at some point. So exciting things coming from California DMV related to work that this community has done. The second kind of update is the Verifiable Credentials Working Group is publishing an old document, but in a new form. So we're generalizing the DID core specifications, kind of the heart of the DID core specification into a specification called controller documents, primarily because that content was being copied and pasted across like 3 different specifications. And so we're trying to just put it into one specification. So there'll be a new controller document specification coming out by with VC working group soon. Status list is going to be, I think, published as a rec. Sorry, not as a rec, as a candidate recommendation very soon as well. So good progress there. There's a rechartering that's going on for the group that's going to try and extend the group's lifespan by another 2 years to basically finish up the work that we've been doing and then maintain the specifications given the uptake from a variety of different organizations there. Plenty of time to continue to provide input to the VCWG, especially as we try and finalize all that version 2.0 work. there are 10 specifications that the working group is now in charge of publishing. And, you know, we're on a good track to publish those. If not a couple of months later than we had hoped to. That's it for me.
Thank you, Manu. Kalia, please.
The Internet Identity Workshop now has a series of regional events happening, and the next one's in Europe, in Zurich, Digital Identity Unconference Europe. And it's the third week of June, and we will sell out. So if you want to come, please buy your ticket sooner rather than later, and I'll put the link to that in the chat.
Thank you, Kalia. Any other announcements or reminders? A quick preview of the next few meetings. So next Friday, next Tuesday, we will have the CEO of GLIFE, Global Legal Entity Identifier Foundation, Stephen, to come on and actually present on what they're working on GLIFE. And then the week following, we will have the culture of Open Wallet Foundation's Credential Format Comparison Group to talk about credential format, different credential formats. And then at the end of May, we will have Anil here to talk about Department of Homeland Security's technical implementation requirements for decentralized identity. So that's what's coming. All right, any updates on the work items? Any thoughts? Manu, please.
We do have, you know, I mean, we've been meeting regularly for the Verifiable Credential API. And for those of you that may not have heard, there's a new digital credential API that is in incubation at W3C, with the goal of supporting multiple different formats, multiple different protocols, things of that nature. It's a browser, native browser API for like moving credentials around the web. They did some really cool demos at IAW recently. You know, are looking for, you know, which formats should be supported, which protocols, which query formats should be supported and that kind of stuff. So there's been some requests for us to be more active in, that work. For those of you that are interested in participating, it's a very active, healthy group, meets, I believe, Mondays and Wednesdays alternating. I should find a link for people. Give me a, if you search for digital identities, W3C, it should come up. Sorry, I don't have the link on me right now. Anyway, just a heads up that there's some work item work that we're doing in CCG that's influencing, some of the discussion over there. That's it.
Thank you, Manu. All right. Last calls for introductions or announcements or work item related stuff. All right, let's get to the main agenda. So again, very excited here to have Manu to talk about and lead a discussion on parallel signatures in verifiable credentials. He has already sent out a presentation deck. I'll paste the link here so you can walk along with it. But Manu, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Harrison. Thanks, folks, for having me. Let me go ahead and share the screen. Okay, so the kind of discussion today is on this concept called parallel signatures. It is a technology that, was incubated in this community group, which then went standards track at the World Wide Web Consortium and is now in the candidate recommendation phase with multiple people implementing and demonstrating interop through the test suites. And so we're just going to kind of go over the basics today. What is it? why is it useful? How is it different from the other, you know, signature mechanisms out there today? And then what does the future look like for this particular technology? As always, please just interrupt me, raise hand or Q plus or whatever as we go along. If you have any questions, we can definitely make this more of a conversation than a presentation. Okay, so let's dive in. The things we're going to cover today is just kind of some of the security, privacy, and format challenges that exist when you're doing verifiable credentials or digital credentials of any kind. We're going to talk about how the parallel signature solution tries to address some of those challenges. We're going to go through some examples of like how it works, like high level examples of how it works, and then discussion either during or at the end. Okay, so let's kind of talk about some of the challenges that motivated the work. When we're doing verifiable credentials or digital credentials of any kind, there are a number of challenges that we have to kind of meet. We have to meet all of these challenges, right? One of them is the security challenge, which is like, how do we digitally sign this verifiable credential in a way that follows government cryptography standards? And there are many organizations that kind of publish cryptography standards that are used by government. NIST, ETSI, IEEE, ISO all publish cryptography standards. And then governments decide whether or not they're gonna use it. And that decision tends to be somewhat separated from private industry. Like private industry tends to adopt cryptography more readily, earlier than most governments do. And when governments basically say they're gonna adopt some level of cryptography, like they really mean it. Like that is, and they expect their vendors to comply and systems built to comply and all that kind of stuff. The reason is because it has national security implications. If you choose a weak digital signature format, it could be a national security risk. Okay. So one of the challenges is getting the security right in a way that like governments and big organizations are going to adopt it. The other thing when we secure verifiable credentials, has to do with like privacy challenges. So, you know, how do we digitally sign something so that an individual's privacy is protected? Specifically, how do we enable selective disclosure and how do we enable unlinkable disclosure? So the difference between those two terms is selective disclosure allows you to like show certain fields in, let's say, like a driver's license. So you can share only your address or only your date of birth, right? That's selective disclosure. But the thing usually with selective disclosure is it's not unlinkable, meaning like if you show that you're over 21 using like an MDL at one website and then you do it at another website, well, the digital signature on that that credential that you send over, the selectively disclosed credential, is correlatable. It's trackable. So the sites could get together and collude and start tracking you as you go from site to site, proving your age. Unlinkable disclosure, on the other hand, makes it so you can't be tracked. The digital signature changes every time you do that presentation. And as a result, it's unlinkable. Well, one website can't link your usage to another website. So we have these privacy challenges. And a lot of government cryptography today does not support unlinkable disclosure, for example. So that's why it's a challenge to meet both of those at the same time. The third thing, of course, is a format challenge. So we want to meet the security challenges and meet the privacy challenges, but without having to like re-encode the verifiable credential for every different type of feature we want out of it. Right. So there's kind of like this triumvirate of challenges that we're trying to solve for all of these, at the same time. And in a way that's easy for people to use and so on and so forth. Okay. So there are basically two ways of digitally signing information, these days. One of them is called an enveloping format. And the other one, is, all you'll hear is basically an embedded format. So you have enveloping signature formats and embedded signature formats. So we'll go on option one, talk about that, which is the enveloping signature format. So the idea with the enveloping format is like you have one verifiable credential, but you end up copying that into different envelopes, and the envelope is a security mechanism. You can think of it like, you know, writing a message down, putting it in an envelope, and then sealing it with a wax seal. Like, that's your digital signature. The nice thing about enveloping formats is, like, they're much simpler for security software implementers. So people that are writing the cryptography libraries have an easier time creating these kinds of signatures, because the code that you write to do it is just kind of straightforward, right? The problem, though, is that every time you want a new feature set, you have to invent a new enveloping format, right? And so if you want selective disclosure, well, you have one approach. But if you want unlinkability, well, you've got to create a new enveloping format, and so on and so forth. So it's more complex for people writing digital wallets and verifiers to deal with all these different, you know, enveloping formats. There's a lot of protocol complexity that comes in, because, you know, if you're going to issue, for example, a driver's license that is both selectively disclosable and unlinkable and follows, you know, government cryptography standards, you would have to digitally sign this credential. You'd have to, you know, copy it multiple times and put each one in a different envelope, and you hand over like the multiple envelopes to the, you know, wallet software. So there's wallet complexity, protocol complexity, all that kind of stuff. Some examples of enveloping formats are like VCJOT 1.1, VCHOSI, VCCOSI, SDJOT, JWP. Each one of those is a different envelope format requiring different sets of rules and different kind of encapsulating thing. Okay, so we've got enveloping formats, and then we've got embedding formats. So the other option here is that we embed the digital signature in the message itself. The idea here is that you just have the original verifiable credential, and each time you want to add like a specific type of signature to it with different capabilities, you just kind of attach it to the end of the verifiable credential. So you have one payload that has multiple different proofs on it. Now the benefits here is that, like, it's a JSON data structure, so you can continue to process it as JSON. You don't have to, like, encode it in this envelope that's opaque that you can't, you know, see through. It's simpler to manage for most developers because most developers know how to just deal with JSON. And the security format, the mechanism is the same between selective disclosure, between full disclosure, selective disclosure, and unlinkable disclosure. The payload stays the same. It's just like the verifiable credential, and all you're doing is kind of like attaching these proofs to it. It's also simpler for devs that have to manage and process VCs. Like, they can take these things and just directly put them in the database instead of having to, like, have the security format and the envelope impact what they put in a database and what they pull out of it and how they verify and all that kind of stuff. So it's like this one simple payload that can be, that has all these different features, security features, that meets all of the challenges that I mentioned before. Now, it is more complex from a security implementation standpoint. Like, the people that write security software, have a much harder time implementing it because there's more to it, right? This is about pushing complexity around, right? Where are we pushing the complexity? Are we pushing it up so that every single developer has to deal with it? Or are we pushing it down and making the security software implementers' lives, you know, more difficult? So an example of, you know, embedded signatures is the W3C data integrity work. Okay, so we've got these two options, enveloping and embedding. Okay, and as I mentioned, the question is, where do you push the complexity? It's not getting rid of complexity, right? Because both there is complexity in both systems. It's where are you pushing the complexity to, and who's got to deal with that? And that's really what, you know, I think often this is discussed as a one is simpler than the other problem. But when you look at it from an ecosystem perspective, you've got, you know, similar levels of complexity. You just need to figure out who's going to deal with and manage that complexity. Okay, so we're just going to focus on parallel signatures today. That is the embedded proof mechanism. It's the thing where you have like one verifiable credential and you just attach multiple different signatures, multiple different proofs to that one verifiable credential. The actual like section of the specification, which is linked to here, talks about this as proof sets. So it's a set of proofs, where you can have one or more proofs attached to a verifiable credential. Then with those kind of multiple proofs attached to the credential, the holder, can then decide which one of those proofs they want to use when they engage with a verifier. Now, clearly the verifier also has to support like selective disclosure or receiving an unlinkable disclosure or whatnot. But the idea here is that, you know, the issuer issues a credential with multiple different options. The holder has those multiple different options and the verifier says, you know, I accept, you know, option A and option C, but not option B, right? So you can think of this as like you're getting a certificate and you've got multiple different locks that you can use to prove to the verifier that it's, you know, digitally signed by the issuer, but the holder has the choice in which lock they attach every single time they do a presentation. Okay, so fundamentally, that's kind of, you know, how this works. The issuer starts with a credential that they want to give to a holder. They choose what types of security features they want the holder to have. So they decide whether or not they want the credential to be fully disclosable or selectively disclosable or unlinkable or all of the above. And they generate those proofs, they put them on one payload, and they send it to the holder. The holder in their digital wallet now has that verifiable credential with all these different like security and privacy features. And then they go to a verifier, and the verifier goes, I want, you know, you to prove something to me. Give me a verifiable credential. But then the verifier can say, but I'm totally fine with you just selectively disclosing your birthday, for example. Or I'm totally fine with you unlinkably disclosing that you're over the age of 21, right? And then the holder, and really it's their digital wallet software, will in an ideal world, pick the most privacy-protecting mechanism when engaging with that verifier. So what the parallel signatures solution does and what the data integrity work does is it makes a conscious decision to push the complexity down in the stack, like way down to the depths of the securing format. And the reason that it does this is to simplify lives for everybody else up the stack, which is most developers, right? There's a very small group of developers that actually write security software, and they are typically more highly trained. Their code is audited on a much regular basis. They focus on like SDKs and libraries, and there are just far fewer of them to focus on and make sure they get it right versus everybody else way up in the stack that may have to juggle all the complexity of multiple different envelope formats. So that's where kind of W3C data integrity makes a different decision than has traditionally been made in kind of the cryptography community. We're saying don't expose web developers to all this complexity, all this envelope complexity, you know, push it down way deep into the libraries and have the libraries, and those highly trained developers, deal with it. Okay. So, let me pause there. We're going to start looking at like some code examples and what it looks like. Are there any questions on like conceptually what we're trying to do? Around like, you know, the formats or the challenges we're trying to meet. Patrick, please go ahead.
Yeah, for me, there's like two angles that I might have questioned, and it's more to more validate, make sure I understand. So in the data integrity spec, it talks about proof sets and proof chains, mm-hmm. which are two different things, but they're both essentially a parallel set of signature. Or are proof chains not considered parallel signature?
That's a great question. Let's see. So, proof sets and proof chains are different. I would say that proof chains are not really parallel signatures. They have different uses. So a proof set is like you have a piece of paper and multiple people sign, put their signature on that piece of paper. Like literally they sign the piece of paper. But none of their signatures are dependent on the other, right? It's just like you've got a piece of paper and you've got eight people's signatures on it, and maybe you only need one of those signatures to prove, you know, what you want to prove. So they're made in parallel. They're not dependent on one another. Proof chains are signatures that are dependent on one another. So you can think of like a notary use case where you go into a notary with a piece of paper and the notary's like, show me your ID, and you show them your ID, and then they're like, okay, sign this piece of paper. They always have you put your signature on the paper before they put their signature on the paper. Because what their signature is supposed to do is prove that you signed that thing, you know, in front of them. So that's an example. Like a notary is an example of a chained signature where you put your signature on it first and then the notary puts their signature on it. And so there, you can combine these things in like arbitrary ways. But fundamentally that's the difference between these things. And just today I'm only talking about proof sets. I'm not talking about proof chains. That helped.
Right. Yeah, that helped. And that sort of leads into my second question, which is, do all signature need to come from the same issuer?
Great question. No, they don't. They could come from totally different issuers.
Right. Because in the example you said, so the issuer applies multiple proof when he issues, but there could be a case that the holder could require an additional signature from another issuer on that same credential. Could
exactly.
that be a use case for parallel yep. signature?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you could have, I mean, there's a question around, like, should you chain those signatures together, or is it okay to have them parallel? Yeah, the verifier can say, you know, I want a verifiable credential that has not only been signed by, like, this is a stretch, but like a university credential where you have, like, the department issue the degree, and then you have the registrar sign over sure. that, and then you have like the certification body or the you know accreditation body. Now, that doesn't map very cleanly into the way it works today. So maybe somebody has a better example of like you know, but yes, the general idea here is like you could have totally different. Issuers sign over the same credential and have an aggregation of signatures. A board making a decision would be an example of that. Like, if you wanted, like, the minutes of a board meeting individually signed by both people, those are different, you know, signatures that would go on.
I don't know if it's just me, but I think your sound is getting
breaking.
Strange.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Let though. Me know if it.
Good again.
Okay, good. All right, I think we have other folks on the queue.
Yes, PLT3.
Hi, Manu, this is Phil. Can I interpret then that or let me just ask the question, if a holder, if an individual receives a credential from an issuer, is it possible for the holder to themselves choose which particular fields to selectively disclose, or is that done by the issuer at the time that the credential is made?
That's an excellent question. We will get into that in the latter part of the slide deck.
Okay.
I'll have an example that goes exactly to that question.
Okay, so the follow-up
then? The answer
then,
is yes. The answer
okay.
is yes. Yes.
Good. And so the question then is, I'll leave it at that and we'll follow up. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Dimitri?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
So I would, just as a brief aside on proof chains, I would caution people to model business flows and business logic as proof chains, because it creates a temptation of stuffing business model fields into proof objects. For any given example that has been given so far, like for example, in the university setting where it was first signed by the department and then approved by the registrar. In order to do something like that, you start trying to stuff, for example, approved by the registrar into a signature object where it doesn't belong. For any given workflow that you're tempted to model as a proof chain, consider modeling it as several different credentials that just link to each other. That's it.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Dimitri. I think people see like the flexibility that could be done with like proof sets and proof chains. And like, you know, the mind goes wild and you're like, oh yeah, I could do all these things. But I think, Dimitri, you're absolutely right. Like, just keep it simple. At least these are early days. You know, the second, as Dimitri said, you've got some kind of business process, it's probably better modeled as a set of VCs than trying to overload the signature mechanism.
Right. Great. You're next.
Hi. I just wanted to qualify a little bit about the notion of increase in complexity. Like, for example, with BBS signatures, when we use VCs as opposed to JWP, both cases use the same fundamental algorithm. It's just in the case of the parallel signature, the data integrity approach, we have to do some more pre-processing. Because we allow general credentials rather than a bunch of fixed fields to get there. And sometimes that means we have to take into account and be just a little bit more careful. For example, if you're going to do something that's unlinkable and you're using a general VC, you have to be careful not to put in IDs that could identify and act as lose the unlinkable property, but we're still using the same cryptography either way. Okay. Whether it's EDDSA, ECDSA, BBS, it's just the processing before we get to those algorithms is a bit more complicated because we're dealing with general credentials rather than fixed. So I don't want to make it sound like it's a lot more hard to secure these things.
Yeah. Excellent point. Yeah, absolutely. One of the driving reasons for this approach was we needed to be able to sign things in ways that governments would accept today. And by and large, that cryptography is just, you are correlatable. You are fully trackable. It's like full disclosure type thing, right? We can get to selective disclosure with modern cryptography, with standard government issued cryptography, but trying to do unlinkable there are no accepted government standards for that. So we needed to be able to create verifiable credentials in a way that governments would receive. But remember I said like private organizations sometimes lead governments by a decade in accepting new types of cryptography. So we wanted to be able to sign these things in a way that governments would still accept it, but private industry would be more privacy preserving because they have mandates from like privacy regulation that says that they should be minimizing data. So private industry can accept a BBS signature, right? When a government might not be able to. And the reason we put the signatures in parallel is we're giving the holder the choice of like, hey, you have an option of doing an unlinkable disclosure at this point. You should definitely use that proof instead of the fully disclosable one, right? Avoid being correlated. Go ahead. I think, Harrison, you're on the queue as well.
Yes. I do have a clarification question. So for SD Jot, you mentioned that it's an envelope approach. So it's not possible to implement SDJOT's ideas in the embedded approach, right? The option two. Is that correct? Or is it possible to implement it in the in that approach?
You can, but there's a technical limitation with all of the enveloping mechanisms where you have to repeat the information. You have to repeat the data, or you have to do this weird detached signature thing. We actually, in the 2018 signature suites, we did use detached signatures. But ultimately it was kind of like this weird hybrid thing, that I think both communities ended up not really liking that much, both the enveloping communities and the embedded communities. It's possible, Harrison, but there are a whole bunch of kind of downsides with doing that.
Got it. Thank you.
All right. I think we have a clear cue. I'm going to keep going. Okay. So what does this actually look like? We're going to actually look at some examples here and see how we, you know, build up the example. So, a verifiable credential with multiple proofs on it. This is what it looks like. So you've got your standard, like, verifiable credential. This is for a permanent resident card. You've got, you know, some fields here. And then in the proof, you'll see that this is an array. It's a set of different proofs. And we'll look into the dot, dot, dot here in a bit, but this is a verifiable credential that contains five different proofs on it with five different security characteristics and privacy characteristics. There are links to examples, like full-blown examples here that you can kind of go and look at. So if you want it, if you really wanted to look at exactly one of these things looks like here are all the proofs. Right. That's one proof there, second proof, third proof, fourth proof, fifth proof. So this is, let's see, this is an ECDSA one accepted by all governments. ECDSA for selective disclosure, accepted by all governments. EDDSA, this is the true age, you know, signature, which is accepted by governments, but doesn't have a hardware security module compliance program, you know, provided by NIST yet. By FIPS yet, but it will. EDDSA, same thing, as the above. And here's a BBS one. So the holder of this credential could pick any one of these, as the proofing, mechanism. Okay. So let's look at how it works. Ada Integrity has a pretty straightforward pipeline. You get data coming in from the left here, and you end up with the data with an attached proof on it. And each pipeline will do different things, but the end result will be a proof that's attached on the original data. These are three different pipelines here. There's ECDSA, that is like tried and true government crypto as far as the US and Canada and the European Union and their, you know, partner, organizations are concerned. China and Russia have different ideas about what should be used here. They use stuff like SM2. But the ECDSA is largely, you know, USA, Europe, approved cryptography. ECDSASD uses, USA, Europe, approved cryptography to do selective disclosure. You can think of this as kind of like analogous to SDJOT, with some performance improvements or differences between the two. So this is the pipeline for ECDSA SD, and then BBS is a separate pipeline. This is used to do unlinkable proofs. And the data integrity pipeline for all of that is the same. You get data in, you put it into a pipeline. The pipeline will transform the data in some kind of way to prepare it for digital signature. It will then hash the transformed data in some way, and then it will digitally sign the hashed data in some way, and out pops a proof that you add to the data. Now, what each one of these pipelines does at the transform stage and the hash stage and the generate proof stage is different, but the general pipeline's the same. Transform, hash, generate. Transform, hash, generate. That's just what each one of these pipelines does, and that's what data integrity does. This is the ECDSA processing pipeline. So you get any bog standard verifiable credential in. So you get a, pick any example in the spec. You get that in as data. You put it through the ECDSA data integrity crypto suite. it transforms it, and this is what the transformed version of it looks like. It turns every single, it turns that JSON into claims. So each one of these is a separate claim. Like, for example, you can see that, let's see, the card has a description of a Government of Utopia permanent resident card. The identifier associated with it is this identifier. The name of the card is permanent resident card. It is a permanent resident card. It is a verifiable credential. It was, you know, issued on this date. It expires on this date. And then you take all that data. That's, this is transformed, and then you hash it into a cryptographic, hash, and then you generate the proof. And this is the proof value that pops out. The signature size is 64 bytes, 89 when you put it in JSON format, and then you kind of attach, that proof to the data. If you look at ECDSA SD, the transform stage does something slightly different. So the issuer, and this is going back to the question that you asked, Phil, the issuer decides which statements are mandatory. Like whenever the holder discloses it, they always have to disclose, in this case, the validity period, the valid from and valid until, and the issuer. Like they always have to provide that information, but everything else can be selectively disclosable. Like this is a employee credential. So like their name, their job title, the corporation that they work at, which division in the corporation they work with, the employee ID, all of these statements, each one of these individual statements is selectively disclosable. The signature, as you can see down here, is more complex than a standard ECDSA signature. We did another presentation a while ago to cover like what each one of these things are, but, you'll see that there's one base signature on all the mandatory fields, and every single selectively disclosable, thing has its own signature, that can be disclosed. And then you've got a total signature size that's, larger. BBS, very much the same kind of thing. The transform step is actually the same between selective disclosure and unlinkable disclosure, but the cryptography that we use is different. So the hash data and the generate proof stages are different. You get a BBS signature, and there's a BBS header and a public key and an HMAC key to ensure privacy. We do have mandatory disclosure fields as well, that the issuer can set. And then the signature size is again, different. Okay. So those are kind of the three different processing pipelines, and each one of those pipelines leads to a proof that's added to the verifiable credential. So here is the ECDSA proof. If you want to do full disclosure, here's the ECDSA SD for selective disclosure proof. If you want to do selective disclosure, here's the BBS proof. If you want to do unlinkable disclosure, right? So, this is, again, it's just one payload. You don't have to put it in multiple different opaque envelopes. You don't have to juggle the envelopes. It's like everything is in here. And the digital wallet software, along with what the verifier wants and what the holder is willing to provide, will end up using just, in theory, one of these signatures. You could use multiple of them in some of the more advanced use cases. Okay, so you can try this today. In fact, this was launched out to the playground like a couple of months ago. There's a selection where you can get any of the credentials on the playground where protected by ECDSA, EDDSA, I think ECDSA SD and BBS. Like you can put all the signatures on it. You can look at them, see that it's working, and then you can go and like receive the credential and present the credential. There. Okay, that's largely it for the presentation today. Any other kind of questions on this technology, standardization, where it is in standardization, that sort of thing?
Phil.
Yeah, thank you, Manu. That was really helpful. The one question that still remains for me is that I saw very clearly where you had the set of particular properties that you could selectively disclose or not. But those appeared to be selected by the issuer themselves as opposed to the holder. That is, the holder can select among those that are in that set, but not necessarily that is the appeared as though that the issuer was the one creating that set. Can you clarify that?
Yes. Yeah, you're seeing, yes, that's correct. So, and here's why. When the issuer issues a credential, fundamentally, it is them that's creating the credential for the holder. So for example, think of something like a revocation list. Some issuers might say, you know what? I want the verifier to know that there's a revocation list associated with this credential because I might revoke it from the holder, and I do not want the holder hiding the fact that there's a revocation list from the verifier, right? So in that scenario, the issuer might say it is mandatory to disclose the revocation list, as an example. Or the issuer might go, you know what, this credential has a validity period. I want the issuer to know what that validity period is. I don't want the holder to hide that information from the verifier. All of these things come around, happen because of potential fraud use cases. But there's a market here, right? I mean, if issuers are issuing selectively disclosed credentials where you can only selectively disclose one field and the rest of it is just highly, kind of privacy invasive, credentials, in an ideal world, holders, organizations that hold issuers to account will complain to the issuers hey, you're doing a pretty bad job when it comes to selective disclosure, right? And so there is a natural give and take that we hope takes hold in this ecosystem. I think what the guidance we're going to try and give in the Verifiable Credential Working Group is issuers should make every field selectively disclosable in a verifiable credential by default. That should be your default position. And then only if your legal counsel is no, you cannot make that selectively disclosable, will you be okay, fine, we'll put some mandatory fields in there. And the reason we think that's probably going to be okay is because for something like a driver's license, which is standardized, the verifier will request, if there's a revocation list, the verifier will request a revocation list because they know that these types of credentials always come with a revocation list. And so the holder's not going to be able to hide that information from a verifier if the verifier wants it, right? So I think that's kind of that's what we're trying to do. But, this is a big ecosystem. We're going to see, if there's anyone that pushes back on that. Phil, did that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And I understand the rationale behind it. And I certainly agree with the recommendation in the VC work group that, that it's everything disclosable, as a baseline, and then argue for the cases where that's not or should not be the case. Mm-hmm. That's an exception. And yep. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Phil.
Patrick.
Yeah, I really like that last part, that there's also a responsibility component on the verifier to ask for a non-revocation proof of some sort. Even though if they both rely on the status list, by having a status list selectively disclosable, you then sort of flip the role on the verifier to ask for a proof of non-revocation, because it's not 100% in the holder's control to not show, yes, it is. At the end of the day, you can show not to show his credential, but the verifier can also specifically ask for fields that have been flagged as selectively disclosable. So I think that's really important. My question was, so you mentioned earlier that by having a credential with parallel signature, the holder can then choose which signature to send to a verifier. Would you say that sending only one proof to the verifier is falls onto the generally good practice, or it should be
yes.
a requirement that when it sends for verification, it chooses only one proof?
Let's see. So I don't know what's going to happen in the future, right? So there are exceptions to the question that you asked, but I'm going to try and ignore those for now. So I think in general, you should only be sending one of these signatures, right? You should only send an ECDS. You should decide if the verifier is allowing you to decide between unlinkable, selective, and full, you should pick unlinkable, like by default.
Yeah.
And you should only, and in that case, you should only send the unlinkable disclosure, because if you send the other proofs, you will end up being correlatable, right? However, the caveats to what your question is, like, well, what happens if there are like multiple signatures that are required? Well, the verifier can ask for the specific mm-hmm. signatures that they want. So let's say you have a set of signatures where you require like 2 of 5 signatures. The verifier can say, I want signatures from person A and, or issuer A and issuer B and issuer C. Like they can mm-hmm. request that. And then if you have those proofs, then you know that the verifier is not going to be happy unless you send all 3 different types of signatures. But that's mildly different from like picking between the type of disclosure.
You mean like the verifier could request based on a specific verification method, like if he knows he wants a verification method that supports selective disclosure, he could specifically ask for this?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, not only that, it's there's selection between the type of cryptography that's used, right? So the verifier can say, I want this specific type of cryptography. Like, for example, I am the U.S. federal government. I only support ECDSA or ECDSA-SD. And I want you to tell me what your birth date is, mm-hmm. right? That is the type of request that can come in from a verifier. And then the holder can then go like, okay, I've got 3 of these signatures on here, ECDSA, SD, and DDS. They're asking me for either the thing in purple or the thing in green. So that either the ECDSA proof or the ECDSA SD proof. And the holder's software, the digital wallet, is like, I'm going to optimize for the holder's privacy, so I'm going to use ECDSA-SD, and they're only asking for the birthday, so I'm only going to disclose the birthday to them. So that's an example of like what, you know, the verifier can ask for and how the holder can respond.
This sort of verifier negotiation we're talking about, is there currently a somewhat specified way to do this? Because parallel signatures are fairly new. Is there currently like a presentation request format specifically addressing like which type of proofs to include?
Yeah, it's in the VP request spec. In here, there's there are examples of how you like mm-hmm. request. I think maybe in did authentication, like here it has accepted methods, but it also can have accepted cryptography suites.
See, like, yeah, I see there. Yeah.
Right. So this is the verifier can say, hey, I accept the DID key, DID method and the ECDSA, you know, 2022, crypto suite, for example.
Pretty good.
Yep.
Oh, wait, Molly, I have one clarification question. So earlier in the birthday example, so the holder's wallet will only, instead of showing this entire verifiable credential, just show the birthday plus the ECDSA-SD proof, essentially, and then send it to the verifier. Is that correct?
You got it. Yep, exactly.
Got it. Cool.
Yeah, so every other field in here will not be included. It will just be the individual's birthday.
Got it. Any last questions? Great. Thank you. Thanks, Molly, for a great presentation and a great discussion. I always know, like, when you come on, like, we have a very good discussion. So really look forward to it.
Thank you, Harrison. Thanks a ton for having me, as always. Really appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks. So this concludes this week's CCG meeting. And thanks, Molly. Thanks again. Have a good one.